Hello, this is Dr. Gary Sherman, the Heart Guy, and I welcome you to another exciting and informative podcast titled The Heart Guy Presents the Heart of the Matter, bringing you interesting discussions and conversations related to the vast and important subject of heart disease, heart failure, and organ donation, and everything related to that in today's ever-changing world. I'm extremely honored to have as my special guest today an inspiring leader in our global health community, Fallon Kiefer. Fallon Kiefer is a public speaker, a writer, and an extraordinary patient advocate for both organ donation and polycystic kidney disease. Now 38 years old, Fallon is thriving like never before, thanks to two life-saving transplants, a kidney transplant when she was just 19 years old, and a liver transplant in August of 2018 when she was just turning 35. Despite life challenging her at every turn, Fallon is determined to help others who are fated to walk a similar path. She once again has taken her new lease on life and is intent on paying it back tenfold, working every day to raise awareness of organ donation and PKD, and to help educate and empower others. Fallon has shared her story at more than 100 events across North America, painting an authentic picture of the challenges and joys of this journey. Fallon, welcome to The Heart Guy Presents the Heart of the Matter. It's really a pleasure.
Thank you so much.
Oh, you're welcome. So there's so much that I would like you to help me share with our listeners today, but I think we must give everyone a little background and a window into your extraordinary life. So let's start at the beginning. You grew up near Lancaster, Pennsylvania. Is that right?
Yes. I grew up in York, Pennsylvania, which is about 30 minutes from Lancaster.
Oh, great. Yeah. And I've been to Lancaster many times. York probably drove through, but not sure if I was, but I have to make my business next time I'm in that area. So please tell us the Fallon who was once upon a time a little girl.
Well, I've been a patient since I was 5 years old. That's when I had my first seizure. And I was diagnosed with polycystic kidney disease at the age of 10. So I had a wonderful youth growing up, amazing parents, but it was challenging with hospital stays and illness. Polycystic kidney disease is a genetic disease. So I inherited it from my mother's side of the family and really had challenging youth growing up with cyst bleeds from the disease and really severely ill, and things really got bad at the start of college for me.
Yeah. And so you were just 10 years old when you received the first diagnosis. Tell me a little bit about what PKD is and how that manifests itself for somebody 10 years old.
Polycystic kidney disease is one of the most common life-threatening genetic diseases. And what happens is cysts form on the kidneys. They can grow to the size of footballs, deteriorate in function, and there's no cure. So at this point, dialysis and transplantation are the only options of survival. Just several years ago, the first treatment was released for it called tolvaptan. It's a really challenging disease, a lot of pain. You can have cyst bleeds, high blood pressure, and it's quite debilitating. And for me, I was diagnosed, I went to family pediatrician, had my blood pressure taken. It was 160 over 140, which is just bizarrely sky high, and especially for a little girl. And with the family history, I didn't know about polycystic kidney disease being so young, but of course my mom has it and she was well aware and the doctor new. So they sent me for an ultrasound and both of my kidneys were polluted with cysts. And that's where my PKD journey began.
Wow. Yeah. And so then you went through middle school and high school, going to hospital visits all the while. Did you feel like you were missing out on things that other kids had, or were you able to take that all in stride, even at an incredibly young age?
Looking back, I definitely missed out on things. I wasn't able to participate in sports because my kidneys were so enlarged and the cysts so fragile that they would burst so easily that I couldn't play any contact sport. Mm. I did start to participate in choir and school plays just to be able to, you know, participate and do something in high school. But the wild thing is I had a scene in one of the plays where I just had to faint and fall lightly to the floor. And I did that, and just that little bit of a bump on the floor, the next day I woke up with blood in my urine and a fever and was sick again. So that's how just fragile my kidneys were and the state that I was in. So I definitely felt different and there was no support back then like there is today.
Yeah, and how brave you were to even try it. So that I give you a lot of credit too. Nothing wrong with shows and music. We love all that stuff too. My kids were athletes, but they were also musicians, and we always brought them to Broadway plays here. We're fortunate to be in New York where we had all that available to us. So that I'm glad that you made that attempt. You had to have strong parents in order to do that. And how did they deal with your illness?
They definitely are. They're extraordinary, but being a caregiver is very hard, and especially watching your child so sick in years after years, and the effect that it's had on them has just, of course, caused a lot of stress and worry. And even though I inherited it from my mom, and my mom has polycystic kidney disease, it's basically like my father has it as well because of what he's had to live through and endure and witness and support. And it was really hard on them. I mean, watching a child grow up so sick. I know my mom dealt with the complexities of knowing she passed it on to me, even though I never thought of that aspect. I know it's hard for her thinking that. And when I was at the start of college, I spent almost a year in the hospital. My parents lived in the Ronald McDonald House. Yeah. They were at one point called down to say their goodbyes. So I can't even imagine being in their shoes. I mean, caregivers are just extraordinary. And I feel like sometimes it's even harder for them than the patient.
Yeah, I'm still working on a project. It's on the back burner now that I have so many other things going on. My friend Mary and I were definitely contemplating working on a project that would be a virtual support group for caregivers, because there is the absence of that more or less now. I think it's coming to the forefront, but I don't think there's enough yet been done to support caregivers, because they really take the brunt of the emotional burden that we have as patients, for sure. You did make it to the freshman year of college at Millersville. And right off the bat, of course, you had to check into the hospital again, and this time for a year. So what happened during that time?
Believe it or not, I missed the first half of my senior year because of cyst bleeds, but I graduated on time and with honors, and I started college.
I believe that.
I was at Millersville for 2 months, and I was leaving an extra credit class, walking back to my dorm, and I literally fell to my knees in kidney pain. And I knew what was going on. I was peeing blood. I knew it was another cyst bleed episode. And I went to the hospital, and I wound up staying at Hershey Med Center for 3 months, and they just didn't know what to do. I was getting transfusion after transfusion, and they just kind of said, we don't know what to do. And I would have died if I stayed there. So of course, my parents, that answer was not okay. And they wound up having me transferred to Johns Hopkins. And I was there for many more months, and they wound up taking out both of my kidneys. I was on dialysis. I needed it daily sometimes because of all the toxins. And at the time, when the more you're in the hospital, it almost seems like the more issues that happens. Yeah. So I had pancreatitis, and I wound up having a bleeding vessel in my stomach, and I was just deathly ill. And fortunately, I had a living donor that stepped forward, because at the time I was too sick to be put on the transplant waiting list. So a good friend of the family stepped forward, and my kidney transplant surgeon took the risk of transplanting me at such an ill state. And because of Sally Robertson gifting me with a kidney transplant, my life has now been doubled, and it's just miraculous.
Yeah. And to give Sally a credit, I mean, all the credit that's due. So she was Emily's mom, right? Your friend was Emily, and this was her mom that donated the kidney.
Correct. Yeah. I met Emily when we were in eighth grade. So I've known Sally since middle school, and I'd go over to the house and pick Emily up and hang out, and you know, Sally, was just a part of my life since middle school. And it's just amazing that at that time, full-time job, married, several kids, and makes the decision to step forward and save my life. And to hear her speak about it is so moving, because she felt very called to do that. And it really is amazing to think of how well her kidney is doing today in me. And I'm just so thankful for her in that decision.
And I know she's happy about that, but I am certainly always amazed at the selflessness of the epitome of kindness on the part of someone who is not a family member to make a living donation. You know, I'm involved personally with the heart transplant that I'm waiting for. And I like to say that my donor isn't done with their heart yet, and I will get it. But by the same token, it's a different situation, because we're dealing with a deceased donor instead of a living donor. And for that reason, it's that much more amazing, the selflessness on the part of those people. So for the next 14 years with your new kidneys, you did things and got back to something close to what most people might consider normal. Is that right?
Absolutely. Yeah, it probably took around a year after my transplant to just adjust to the anti-rejection medicines and heal from all of the issues that I had. And then I began working full-time, and I found my passion of being a patient advocate. And I did really, really well for many years until about the fall of 2016.
Yeah. And time goes fast. But 14 years after your kidney transplant, you start getting sporadic bouts of sepsis. And over time, these bouts are getting worse, eventually leading up to the need for daily IV antibiotics. What did your doctors discover at that time?
Well, it was just so wild because we thought, okay, my kidneys were removed, went through all of that as a teenager, almost done PKD, even though it's genetic, I could pass it on. There's other complications you could have from it, but thought like, oh my gosh, the big part has to be behind us. And then all of a sudden getting sepsis just time after time again, I would get fever, rigors, go into the hospital. All my lab work was okay. They did all kinds of tests and couldn't figure out the root cause. It was just started to get so scary. I'd have it like every 6 months and then every 3 months. And it was just got to the point where they didn't know if I'd make it through the next infection, because sometimes people get sepsis once and pass away, let alone multiple times. And I was severely ill, and it wound up with the doctors finally did a PET scan and my liver lit up. And we discovered that I had bile duct plate malformations where the bile ducts in my liver looked like a gnarly oak tree, which was leading to liver infections that spread to my bloodstream because of having a suppressed immune system with the kidney transplant. And then I was told I needed a life-saving liver transplant. And it was like, what?
Yeah.
It was just after all that awful.
Time, you'd been through so much. But it does suggest that, you know, we have to understand that it became actually what I'm going to say is became a realization for me as well, is that it's all connected, you know. So your kidneys were the problem, but it probably led to the liver problem that you ended up having, suggesting that, you know, all our organs and our whole body is connected. So we have to really keep that in mind. I think as patients, we have to understand that, you know, one thing could lead to another, and everything has to be watched. And everything has to be monitored, especially today when there's so much information available. So you got a donation again, this time from a deceased donor. And I want to just mention to remind everybody, and I want to shift here a little bit to the importance of organ donation. Deceased donors can donate as many as 8 whole organs, corneas, blood stem cells, bone marrow, blood, platelets. And now they're adding hands and faces to that list, amplifying the importance of organ donation in this country. All people should consider themselves donors, but dare I say, most still do not. The fact is, newborns and senior citizens can actually be organ donors. There are, unfortunately, so many misconceptions about organ donorship, religion being the biggest one, also the mistrust of the medical system, unfortunately, from what we see on television. So perhaps we can dive right in and have you share with us, Valen, your views on the importance of organ donation and where you feel we are as a global community, perhaps falling short of where we would like to be in that area.
Absolutely. I'm alive today because of it. And twice, I've lived through 2 miracles, once from my living kidney donor and then from my deceased liver donor. I mean, my life has been doubled. Everything I've been able to do the second half of my life is because of 2 people making that selfless decision. And for me, of course, there is still a great need for people to sign up and say yes to organ donation. And I know that's why I'm passionate about spreading the message, and I know you are too. And for me, I think it's important for people to visually see the life-saving impact they can have on someone else, how that yes can change not just the recipient's life, but it's this ripple effect. You know, it gave my parents their daughter back. It made me be able to meet my husband and marry him. It's all of the lives I've been able to touch by sharing my story and the education spread. So I think that's why it's so important for what you and I are doing, because there is a great need for many more people to say yes. And then also for others to learn of living donation, to be able to step forward and save someone's life in that way as well.
You know, it's interesting. I learned from somebody who's very involved with kidney donation from the donor's side, he suggested to me that stories such as yours actually make people feel like it's less possible for them to find somebody who might be a donor for them. They actually think that the chances for them are not possible. I think that we have to do everything we can to make people aware from both sides that we need more donors for it to make more of a reality for people who are looking to have donations so that they can continue their lives.
Absolutely.
It was an interesting thing. So just as you're feeling great in a monumental recovery again now from a liver transplant, the COVID-19 epidemic arrived to a party without an invitation.
Yes.
And how do you think all of your health issues prepared you now for living through this pandemic?
Of course, nobody expected this. And the pandemic began a year and a half after I had my liver transplant. I was the healthiest I had been in years, the happiest. I was coming into this new normal and version of myself that I always hoped for, but never knew if it was going to happen. And I was able to travel and was doing extraordinary speaking events. And then all of a sudden, everything came to a halt. And the kicker is I was so used to being home and sick before my liver transplant, but now I'm healthy and strong and ready to get out there and live life to the fullest and can't go anywhere. It's like, oh my gosh, you've got to be kidding me. At the same time, my husband's extraordinary and a wonderful caregiver, and we had just gone through so much together that I feel like we had this incredible experience and knowledge to help us get through COVID, and our going through all of that together helped us appreciate taking it one day at a time. Mm-hmm. And we already are well aware of how to live life as an immunosuppressed patient with taking care of ourselves and mask wearing, all of that isn't even new to us. But with that said, it's been, of course, really hard, like it has been for everyone else.
Yeah. For me, as a dentist for 36 years, when somebody said that I had to wear a mask all day and wash my hands a lot, well, I had already been doing that for 35 years. So that wasn't a big, I was like, that's no change for me. I've just been doing that my whole life, wearing a mask and washing my hands. But
exactly.
But now it's grown into much more than that. And now we don't know the future. There's so much unknown still, even as we come out of this. You know, we're worried about the variants. We're hearing things about what's going on in India and places like that, and Japan even, where, you know, things are so structured, you would think they have it all together there. But in all parts of the world, it's still not over. And so it's certainly concerning. And I think you're right. I think we have to be cautious about the things we do. Still wear the masks, you know, just go with the CDC on these things. Try to avoid crowded indoor gatherings, because that's how the virus spreads. And even though we're vaccinated, and I guess particularly people who are immunosuppressed, we can still get the virus. And I think people who are not immunosuppressed can still get the virus, even though they've had their two vaccines. We all have to still, hopefully, the message is that we all have to still be careful about this. You've been an active participant in the new Johns Hopkins study, which is seeking answers about the effectiveness of these new vaccines in people who are immunosuppressed. Can you share a bit about what you've learned through this experience and whether you believe that people like yourself can get back to doing normal activities eventually?
Absolutely. This has been fascinating to be a part of, and I'm so grateful for Johns Hopkins for doing this study, because the transplant community didn't have any data on the vaccine. We didn't know the safety of it or the efficacy of it, and that was because we weren't a part of the trials for the general public because of being immunosuppressed. So once the transplant community heard about this, we were like all on board to participate. And the results came out that after the first dose of the vaccine, only 17% of the transplant recipients showed a positive antibody response, which is so shocking, because almost 100% of the general public showed a positive response. So then after the second dose of the vaccine, I think it was about 46% showed a positive response. So basically half of the community built up antibodies and the other half didn't build up any, which is so scary, because that's a vast difference from the general public. And this was so important because we learned a lot that CellCept had a big impact on that. A lot of the transplant recipients who take CellCept, which is an immunosuppression med, that played an impact. So now they need to look into that. So it's just the beginning of learning. But the big thing is we gain the knowledge that a big group of us are protected. So the important thing is spreading that, because there could be people in the community, transplant recipients, who get the vaccine and think that they're protected, and now they're getting back to more normalcy in their lives and they don't have that protection. So this has been a really important thing to be a part of, and I'm really passionate about sharing the message. I'm fortunate that I did produce antibodies, but for the transplant recipients that did, they're saying that we have less of a robust response than the general public anyway. Yeah. So it just goes to show that how careful we need to be. And I really haven't changed anything. I'm being super careful. My husband does all the errands and goes to the grocery store, and I go out to do lab work and medical appointments, but it deals a lot with, you know, how comfortable you are with risk. And I'm just more cautious. I've been through so much. I'm so grateful for my stable health right now. I don't want to do anything to jeopardize that. But at the same time, we do all need to find out how to safely integrate ourselves somehow back into a little bit of normalcy.
Yeah. But you can go outside. You can go outside your house and so forth. You feel comfortable doing that?
Oh, for sure. Yeah. We actually purchased an RV last summer.
Oh, great.
So we go RVing and go out to campgrounds and be able to get out in nature. And yes. And for sure outside. That I'm completely comfortable with, but not just indoors and around a lot of people. Yeah. And
but and that goes, that's very, very important though. It goes to the fact that what we want to tell our listeners is that you can still have a good life, but you have to adapt to change and find new ways to enjoy yourself and to be with your family and be with your husband or wife. You know, there is a way to have a happy life, even though it's a different life. So that's a great message that you share there.
For sure. And I think I strive for that through all of my health issues. When I was super sick and didn't know if I'd receive a liver transplant or how long I would live, my husband and I still strive to be able to find joy in every day and still happy and make the most of each day, because we've learned so often, we don't know what the next day will bring.
Precisely. So, yeah, we don't. And again, COVID gave that realization to a lot of people. And hopefully the good thing about that is maybe we'll be more empathetic. Maybe we'll be kinder to one another. Maybe we'll call that brother or sister that we hadn't spoken to in 15 years over an argument that we forgot the reason that we're not talking, and we will solve those issues, because certain things are more important than others and life is short. And you're a great example of somebody who can share your experience and show people that they can also do the same thing. They can adapt to change as well. So thank you for sharing this about your life and being so transparent. It's great. I'd like to shift gears a little bit and talk about the importance of community for people who have been touched by heart and lung and kidney and liver disease. Where may people who have gone through transplant find the support that they need?
For me, growing up, I didn't have any support as far as support groups and things like that. So I'm so passionate about this, because once I learned of all the different avenues of support in my early 20s, I just kind of dove headfirst into being a patient advocate and volunteering. So I think it's so important for others to find people that are going through the same thing, so they know that they are not alone and have the hope that we all need. If it's people in the transplant community who are in need of a transplant or post-transplant, for me, I reached out to my local organ procurement organization here in Sacramento, Sierra Donor Services, and became an ambassador for them. And that's been a really wonderful avenue for me to connect with other transplant recipients and get involved in volunteering at local booths and encouraging organ donation and different events. They've given me wonderful platforms to share my story. And I really highly recommend that for transplant recipients to find their local organ procurement organization.
Yeah, you make a good point, though. Not only do you get the support you need, but by teaming up with other people who are supporting others, you make friends and you're expanding your whole social base just by doing that, you know, sort of like what we've been doing this year with COVID-19. So you're thriving. I mean, as far as I can see, you're thriving. You look great. So what does your daily or monthly routine consist of?
Well, now this August, I will be 19 years post-kidney transplant, 3 years post-liver transplant, which is just amazing. It's hard for me to even grasp.
Congratulations
that.
For that. No, it's quite an accomplishment. No, you're doing great. Absolutely. But go ahead. Share with us the secret.
As far as taking care of my transplants, I still get monthly lab work done. I take about 20 pills a day. So it's the management of that. really listening to my body. If I have any type of symptoms, communicating with my doctors. I'm a big advocate for myself and others, and listening to my body and acting upon things quickly, like a fever, going to the emergency room, I know has saved my life on several occasions with my sepsis infections. In addition to my transplants, I also have scoliosis. I had major back surgery when I was young with two Harrington rods, and also had several back surgeries when I was an adult. So that actually is a day-to-day thing that I navigate, of trying to take care of myself and try and help with the chronic pain that I have. So day-to-day, like every day, is sort of focused on how I can take the best care of myself to live with as limited pain and as healthy as I can, and the organs as long as I can. Also, my advocacy, I think, plays a huge part in my overall well-being and health. Turning my challenges into something meaningful totally changes the perspective of all of my health issues. And that passion really, I think, fuels my positivity and keeps me in a really good place. And then, of course, the encouragement and love that I get from my parents and my husband are huge. Just always having something to look forward to and knowing I have that support is amazing.
I was talking to Dr. Hugh Kasiri. He's a local hero here in Long Island. He's he's actually the head of critical care at my hospital here at Northeastern University Hospital. And we were talking about gratitude. One of the things that he instilled in his team up there in CCU was the fact that every day they would thank each other for the work that they did, for being teammates. So they would thank each other for what they did for each other. Then they would thank each other for what they did for the patients. And the patients would feel that and actually benefit from knowing that there was all this gratitude going on. So it benefited the person that receives the gratitude, but it also benefits the person who delivers it. And I think there's a lot to be said about that. So when we say nice things and do nice things for people, and even just this simple thing like smile in the street, I think that everybody is a benefactor of those things. So maybe the recipe has to do with positivity, like you suggest. But what I don't want to leave out, and what I think is important to notice, is when you listen to Valen speak, you have to put the work in. You know, she's not here because she's lazy. You have to put the time in, and you have to keep working on yourself. And whatever the challenges are, it's not easy. So the work has to be done. You know, there's this talk about genius in some people. The Beatles were geniuses, or Mozart, or all that. And I think we've learned through some of the writings of Malcolm Gladwell that they're not just geniuses. They are special, but they put in the time. You have to put in those 10,000 hours, and you can't do anything. I can tell you, I'm working on my golf game, and you know, I've hit 10,000 balls. Now I'm not Tiger Woods yet, but I'm trying to get there, but I'm a lot better than I was because I work at it. And I think that we have to work to even, you know, get to the point where we can take a few more steps each day. So positivity and work is a pretty good recipe, I suppose.
Thank you. I appreciate that. And I wholeheartedly agree with it. I do work really hard. And some days when you're a patient, you wish that the pain would go away. You wouldn't need to do the work to be listed for a transplant. You just wish you would be okay. And unfortunately, dealing with health issues does come with a lot of work. But I believe that if you do put that in, you are going to live the best life possible that you can.
Absolutely. No question about it. Before we wrap up, I want to share Valen's website with everyone. And Valen has said, and I quote, "Whether that is signing up to be an organ donor or being a living donor, I want donors to know how life-changing and life-saving their gift can be. And I want recipients to know that there is such a beautiful life to live post-transplant." I thank you for those words. Thank you for that. They're beautiful.
Thank you.
Yeah, sure. Go ahead.
I just wanted to share two things. Well, the website's valenkiefer.com, and I wanted to make sure that the listeners knew that you only receive one transplant, because earlier when we were talking, when you had mentioned kidneys, sometimes people get confused with that, as even though both of my kidneys were removed, I only received one transplant and I just have one kidney right now.
Right. So two were removed and then you get one in return.
Yes.
Right. But it's been a very special one because it's serving you well.
It has.
So as bad as it was and still is for so many people in the world, it seems to me through my work as a supervisor for New York State Contact Tracing Initiative this past year, COVID-19 has awakened the sensibilities of so many people. First, making them more aware of their own mortality. And second, perhaps being more in tune with what others are going through or have gone through. Have you felt that people are sensible or have those sensibilities now yet with the people that you've reconnected with?
Well, I think it's really powerful what you said, because it's almost like the world is getting a bit of a glimpse into what it's like living with chronic health issues. Because you have to adapt to change. You kind of constantly have new normals. I've had so many chapters of new normals in my life. And going through all that I have has given me empathy. And I think I've been able to connect with so many people because of all that I've endured. So I do hope that everyone is gaining that. And I think we're at an exciting point where we've learned a lot. We've had to change our lives a lot over the last year or so. And we can almost create this new version of ourselves. And we're at the point of what's that going to look like?
Wow.
And I think it's just a really exciting time where we can choose to be grateful for where we are today, that we're all alive and healthy and we've made it through this to this point, and figure out how we're going to take the knowledge we learned and use it for better for people and to be able to help others. And
absolutely.
I think, yeah.
Yeah, no, and thank you, Valen. Oh my God, you know, you made my day. I can tell you that. And if you made my day, I suspect you're going to make the days of the people who are listening and sharing this special podcast with us. I'm so glad that we did this. It's been my great honor to have you as a guest on The Heart of the Matter. And behalf of myself and our listeners, I thank you so much for all that you have done in your local community and for your local community and for the global community with your incredibly inspiring personal story and with your dedication to your work in an effort to help others realize their own inner strength, and for certainly for sharing this time with us. I hope we can do this again soon.
I hope so too. It's been a pleasure. Thank you, Gary.
And our pleasure as well. Oh my, this has been a wonderful day. That is our podcast for today. Please join me next time for another intriguing, informative, and entertaining conversation. Please visit our website at www.drheart2heart.net. That's D-R-H-E-A-R-T, the numeral 2, H-E-A-R-T.net. For upcoming podcasts, or if you would like me to host an online presentation for your group or organization. If you'd like to be a guest on the Heart of the Matter podcast, please email me at theheartguyspeaks@gmail.com. Our podcast can be found on Apple iTunes, iHeartRadio, Google Podcasts, Spotify, and there'll be probably several more platforms if I can think up a few more. There are plenty of them. You just have to search The Heart Guy Presents The Heart of the Matter and you'll find it. So until next time, this is Dr. Gary Sherman, The Heart Guy, wishing you peace and hope.